This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. Wow, we've like at 800-something shows now, and that's only because we have this beautiful, ever-growing and apparently rapidly expanding audience. I love the notes we get from all over the place. Thanks for listening. I know time is the most precious commodity and you listen. Today we have a gift for you. And it's really a gift for me too. I knew her from a wonderful book called Radical Candor. And now she's written a book called Just Work. And at first when I saw the title, I thought, huh? And then when I dove in, I thought, oh, this is incredibly clever. You're allowed to curse on What Matters Most. In fact, it's one of the few podcasts where cursing is not only permitted, it's encouraged. So I can say the second half of the title in full. Get shit done, fast and fair. And it is such an honor to welcome finally to the family, officially, Miss Kim Scott. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be speaking with you. And many thanks go out to all of your listeners for listening in.
And we're going to dive into the book, and I know I have a lot of CEOs and entrepreneurs who listen. I want to save you millions of dollars. This book is literally could be your curriculum. It is so thorough. I mean, wow. And we'll get into that in a bit. And also, on the cover, Henry Louis Gates Jr., who happens to be a friend who lives in the vineyard in the summer. I know him as Skip Gates. He wrote, Just Work. Left me optimistic that we can create just workplaces. How do you know Dr. Gates?
All good things go back through my editor. Tim Bartlett is a friend of Skip Gates and reached out to him and sent him the book. And I can't say what an honor. I've read his books. I've admired him from afar for a long time. So it was a real honor to have him read one of my books.
And I have to say, he's one of the busiest, most beautiful souls and productive, genius, humble, with a wicked sense of humor. It's a big deal. He doesn't do a lot of that.
Yeah, I was really grateful to him for doing it.
Wow. Well, shout out to you, Skip, and I'll see you soon in the vineyard, I hope, on the old tricycle you ride.
I just want to come. Can I come too?
You're coming. We already talked before. I don't want to say concoct a reason because in case the IRS drops in, but we will have a real presentation post-pandemic. Speaking of which, I was curious, about all my guests. Kim, how have you handled the last year in COVID? How has it affected you? Has it changed you in any way for the positive or perhaps even in unfortunate ways?
You know, it has been such a difficult time for everyone. And so I want to say, first of all, recently my father passed away and I was able to go and be with him at the very end. And that was really a sacred time. And I just want to express so much empathy for all the people who weren't able to be with loved ones in these times because of COVID. So I just want to start by expressing great compassion for all the pain that COVID has caused. And at the same time, to answer your question, I have to say that for a writer, quarantine, there's a lot of silver linings of quarantine. It really allowed me to stop traveling and to focus on finishing Just Work in a way that might not have happened had it not been for quarantine. Had it not been for the combination of quarantine and my husband, who really took all the burden of homeschooling. Suddenly our 11-year-old twins were at home with us all day, every day. And he allowed me to sort of go out to the shack in the backyard and just work.
Wow. And I'm silent because I really feel for you losing your dad. I don't care how old we are. That's not easy. And I miss mine every day, all the time. Just the greatest man ever. And that changes you because you're never the same when you lose a parent or both.
Yeah. No, a friend of mine's mother said, when you lose a parent, the world tilts on a new axis. And that is true.
Well, I want to ask you a couple things because it's rare that we get somebody this smart in here. It was, you know, they're too wise to me. Actually, no, the guests are fantastic. All the listeners are going, wait a minute, we only complain about you.
I know that's not true, Paul.
I have a question for you. Have you seen the brilliant and yet disturbing film, The Social Dilemma? And if so, what'd you think of it?
I have seen it. And I thought that it raised some good points, but I thought it was too exaggerated. It was a little bit like the book, The Circle, which was really a great book. I enjoyed it, but it wasn't a realistic picture of what it's like in tech. I think that there are, you know, you get what you measure, and all these social networks are, at a certain point, they're measuring the wrong things, and so we're getting the wrong kinds of behaviors. I wish I had some brilliant solution to this problem. You know, there's days when, like all of us, I think the answer is just to turn it all off. And especially, you know, my kids just turned 12, and I'm really alarmed about what social networking is going to do to the rest of their childhood.
I'm so grateful that I grew up without it because we were outside all the time and being made to come inside was the punishment. And it's interesting, Kim, I've had so many people on here, congressmen and brilliant this and that and authors, and no one really has a great solution to how are we going to get our arms around this tech thing. It's like the genie's out of the bottle. There's a million good things about it. And yet we're seeing Facebook in particularly, I feel like, has caused some real problems in terms of our democracy. And then overseas, we've seen it used for genocide. And yet, I've asked some of the smartest people in the world on here, and they're not sure. And I'm sure the people who are running these platforms, while, of course, everyone wants to make money, there's some smart people. Not all of them are evil. They're trying to figure it out, too. Tristan Harris has had some great ideas. Do you have anything that you would do, because we never know who's listening, that maybe something might land?
You know, one thing that I think I would do is, I'm, as you could probably tell reading the book, I'm a big believer in checks and balances. And the thing about these social networks is that they are sort of natural monopolies. And as we saw in Texas, natural monopolies need some regulation. They need some checks and balances. And so I think that if I were running a social network, one thing that I would do is I would voluntarily lay down some of my power, and I would say, look, we need to decide what kinds of speech we're not going to allow on our platform, and we need to define it as best as we can, and then we need people who are gonna implement, who are gonna enforce these policies. And I think that because it is, there are enormous externalities with a natural monopoly, and it is not, I don't think it's realistic to say that the companies themselves can manage these. I think that is, like, at a certain level, that is the role of government. So I do think we need, if not some government oversight, we need some external oversight of some sort. Now, what that looks like, is it a group of philosopher kings? It's easy for me to say that. All I can tell you is I'm really glad I'm not the CEO of a big social network right now. But I do think that they have been too fast to abdicate responsibility for the kinds of things that happen. There was a friend of mine approached an executive at a big social network, and she works on issues of teenage bullying. And she said to this executive, children are getting bullied and committing suicide as a result of your social network. And the executive replied, I'm not sure what to do about that. I'm allowed to curse, you said. You know, my response is, it is your fucking job to figure out what to do about it. And that is not an acceptable answer. And if that's your answer, the public's response should be to shut this thing down.
I think you nailed it there, because the book is filled with personal responsibility, because that's the only way, and collective responsibility. You can't have that much power, and any monopoly does. If we still had Standard Oil or one power company, And you made an excellent, you alluded to Texas. Well, look what happens when you deregulate. You know, it's a nightmare. You can't have unfettered capitalism, which is made up like all systems, without some governing mechanism in a healthy, thriving democracy. Otherwise, you won't have democracy. You'll end up with fascism, corporate fascism. And you don't want to kill entrepreneurial spirit. It's almost like if you make one sensible gun law, doesn't mean they're going to take everyone's guns. So everyone settle down. But even the people that work for the tech companies, I think, are haunted by that. And bullying and suicide and females, especially with body image and things like that, that was some of the stuff I was thinking about, where we can't be losing kids and also encouraging this kind of stuff or insurrections. I mean, if we're in doubt and that's a byproduct, then we need to turn it off until we figure it out or do something.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think that one of the things I talk about in Just Work is the only thing that's going to end bullying is consequences for bullying. And at this point, the social networks have really reaped enormous benefit, enormous revenue from the bullying that occurs on their platform, because it's engaging at some level. It gets clicks. And until we figure out how to design a system that doesn't reward the worst kinds of behavior, we're going to get more of the worst kinds of behavior.
Yeah, because they're just designed to make money, which leads me into the same stream of consciousness here on how do we improve capitalism so it works better for more people in a healthy and holistic way, and not just a few. In the pandemic, the billionaires' wealth has gone up like by 1.3 or 4 trillion, and we're seeing food lines of cars for 10 miles and people dying because they don't have heat or insulin, losing health care in a pandemic. And I don't know, this is just the way it is, because for those folks that actually know that Western Europe exists, go look it up. And don't drop Venezuela on me, please. That's not anything. That's just a crazy authoritarianism or the old Soviet Union. Go look at how Denmark and some of these other countries do things. Any ideas? Is it along the same lines, Kim, on how we can improve capitalism for everyone so we don't kill ourselves off?
Yeah, so you are bringing me back to the first book I ever wrote. So the first book I ever wrote, which never got published, maybe as a result of this podcast, somebody will publish it. It's called The Measurement Problem. And I spent the first 4 years of my career the first 2 years in the Soviet Union, and then it became Russia. So this was 1990 to 1994. And it really struck me at the time how terrible that system was, but also it sort of made me think about our own system. So the idea of the measurement problem is that capitalism is really good at rewarding what it can measure, but really bad at rewarding those things that are most valuable but harder to measure. And so it's a novel. It's not an economic book. It's about a woman who falls in love with a Russian entrepreneur and an American humanitarian aid worker at the same time. So it's a lighthearted critique of capitalism. But I really do think we need to learn how to measure, to better measure or at least reward the things that are most valuable. So it's really easy to measure clicks and as a measure of engagement. It's really hard to identify even things you would think were easy. It's hard to identify porn on the internet. It's hard to identify and then to declare that a bad thing. Like these are really those are hard things to do. It's really hard to identify hate speech. It's really hard to define and measure inciting violence. And like unbelievably difficult. But that doesn't mean, just because it's hard, doesn't mean we can say, it's too hard to do, so we're just going to measure clicks, right? So same thing with capital. It's really easy to measure profits. It's really easy to measure who's a good bond trader and who's a bad bond trader and to pay the good bond traders, huge amounts of money. Really hard to measure who's a good teacher and who's a bad teacher. And as a result, our teachers are dramatically underpaid, even though I think almost anyone, I mean, no offense to the bond traders out there, but most people would agree that teaching, being a teacher, is a more valuable thing to do for the world than being a bond trader.
I know. And it's ironic, isn't it? So much of it, the things that do matter most are the hardest to quantify with a monetary system, like the time you spent with your dad. It's priceless. I just this week found a letter my mother had written me 35 years ago. It's worth $1 million. It's priceless, you know, and incredible. Were you in the Soviet Union on that side of the wall when it came down?
No, so the wall came down in 89 in Germany. And then, so I was at the time a senior in college studying arms control. And all of a sudden it was my whole area of study seemed a lot less relevant. Mission accomplished. The Soviet Union, had changed. But so I went over there. I got a job earning $6 a month to do research on military conversion. So sort of swords into plowshares, tank factories that were starting to make little tractors for the newly privatized small farms in Russia.
All right, so I know COVID helped this book come into business and come into being. How did it evolve? What went into your thinking to create this beautiful work?
So I think the seed for the book got planted shortly after Radical Candor came out, and I was in San Francisco giving a Radical Candor talk at a company run by a former colleague of mine, one of too few Black women CEOs in tech. And at the end of the talk, she pulled me aside and she said, "You know, Kim, I really love the ideas of Radical Candor, and I think it's going to help me build the kind of culture that I really want to create at this company. But," she said, "I got to tell you, Kim, it's much harder for me to put it into practice than it is for you. And it's probably harder for you to put it into practice than your husband, who's a white engineer in Silicon Valley." And I knew this was true. I had known her for the better part of a decade. She said, "As soon as I offer even the most compassionate candor, even the kindest, gentlest criticism, I get slimed with the angry Black woman stereotype." And of course I knew that was true, but I also realized in the moment that I had never fully appreciated or noticed how long I had known her and the fact that I had never seen her seem even a little bit irritated, even though in that period of time, believe me, she had what to be pissed off about. And it had never occurred to me the toll that must take on her. And then I started thinking about myself as well. And you know, before I started writing this book, Just Work, if you had asked me, "Have you had any experiences with gender injustice in your career?" I would have said, "Yeah, you know, I had a few bad things happen, but no big deal, really." And as I started thinking about it, I realized this is a hard thing for the author of Radical Candor to admit, but I had been deep in denial. Not only had I not recognized what was happening to my colleague, I wasn't even as aware as one might expect me to be of the things that were happening to me. And I think I had always sort of tried to brush aside these problems as, you know, it's just bullshit. And because it seemed like such an untangleable hairball to me. And when I started thinking about the things that had happened to me, the things that had happened to people I knew and I cared about, I realized it's not an insoluble problem. But in order to solve a problem, you got to parse it. You got to break it down into its component parts so that you can know how to address each part separately. And so for me, I realized there were six very different problems, and we had to confront each of them in very different ways. So the problems, the sort of root causes of injustice in the workplace and beyond the workplace, are bias, prejudice, and bullying. And to me, bias is not meaning it, prejudice is meaning it, and bullying is being mean. And these are three very different attitudes and behaviors. And so responding to bias requires you to sort of invite the other person in to understand the situation from your perspective. And usually they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, once they get it. So you sort of need to hold up a mirror. But with prejudice, if you hold up a mirror, the person is going to like what they see. Like, they believe this. They have a very conscious belief. And they mean it. Whatever they said about you, they mean it. They think it's true. And so that requires a very different kind of response. It's kind of an it statement, letting someone know there's a boundary. You can believe whatever you want, but you can't do whatever you want, and you can't impose your beliefs on me. And so making that clear was kind of an it statement. It is illegal. You can appeal to the law. You can appeal to HR policies, or you can appeal to common human decency. It is ridiculous not to hire someone because of their hair, for example. And then bullying, I learned a lot about how to respond to bullying from my daughter, who was getting bullied in school. And I was sort of giving her the usual I statement advice, you know, tell this child, you know, when you do this, it hurts my feelings. She kind of banged her fist on the table and she said, Mom, he is trying to hurt my feelings. Telling him he succeeded is like giving him a cookie. And I realized she was exactly right. And there was a lot of wisdom there, not only for the schoolyard, but for the workplace as well. The only thing that's going to stop bullying is consequences. And so if you're the target of bullying, you want to use a you statement. You can't talk to me like that. Or if you want a less sort of a more gentle way in, what's going on for you here? But the point is, you're putting the spotlight on the other person, and you're stepping out of a submissive role, and you're getting them to answer the questions for you. So that's the sort of core of the first few chapters of the book, is around the things we can do to address bias, prejudice, and bullying. And then what happens, we got to think about what happens when you layer power on top of that. And then you get discrimination, harassment, and physical violations. And each of these problems needs to be addressed in different ways as well.
Wow, beautiful.
That's a mouthful, sorry. But
No, don't say sorry. I love the in-depth, too. They don't need to hear me. And, you know, I was thinking about this, and you talk about it in the book. And for one, everybody knows, because I have so many dear friends that are women, a lot of the guests, luckily, too, these super wise women around the world have become friends of mine. They keep teaching me a ton. As I've gotten older, I'm just shocked, because I didn't see it as a white male, how much gender injustice permeates everything. I mean, it's like once you put on the magic glasses, your knees buckle. And that's for tall white guy. I can't imagine being at the other end of it. And of course, I've had friends that are minorities. That's another set of glasses. Again, you know, you're knocked on your ass. And you talked about your denial. Why do we work so hard, both individually and collectively, to not see the truth?
You know, Ibram X. Kendi said the denial is the heartbeat of racism. And so it's one of the things that I really thought a lot about, like why we have this, when we observe these problems around us, we have this knee-jerk tendency to be silent about it. There's like a default to silence, and a default to silence for us as leaders. For us, as we tend to be the silent bystander instead of the upstander who says, whoa, that is not right. For us as people harmed. I mean, I was silent way too many times throughout my career about the things that had happened. And also when we get feedback that we've caused harm, there's often for most people, there's a moment of shame. Usually the harm was unintentionally caused. And there's a very defensive tendency. And Jennifer Fried, who's an academic I really admire, she started the Center for Institutional Courage. She calls it DARVO, deny, attack, reverse victim and offender. And she's talking about, her research mostly revolves around people who are accused of sexual assault. But you see it around all from bias to prejudice to bullying to throughout all of it. You see this Darvo response when people have caused harm. So I think that, and for me as a person, you know, I say in the beginning of the book, I never like to think of myself as a victim, but even less do I like to think of myself as a perpetrator. And yet I've played both roles too many times throughout my career. And so part of this book was like therapy for me. Why did I deny what was happening to me? And why, you know, why did I deny what I was doing to other people? You can't do right if you won't admit what you're doing wrong. And I want badly to do the right thing, like most people. And so I think beginning to become aware of this instinct to deny what's happening and beginning to calculate, we're sort of instinctively aware of the costs of speaking up, no matter what our role is. But I think once we begin to improve our analysis and think, what are the costs of silence here? And we know what the risks of speaking up are, but what are the opportunities of speaking up? And as we become more aware of those things and do, I don't want to, especially for people who are harmed by injustice, I don't want to say you have to speak up. The burden should be on everyone. But I do want to help people do a better job calculating the costs and benefits of speaking up. And I think when we do those calculations, we'll speak up far more often. So one big goal of this book is to change the default to silence.
What do you say right now, because we have such a broad and wide audience, to anybody who is in a situation that's tough? You've done all this research. Not every situation's safe. But are there any good ways to start breaching this, to bring the light of day onto it, to bring transparency into the room? A good method?
Yes. Remember, it's a 6x4 matrix. It's not just a 2x2. So you've got bias, prejudice, bullying, discrimination, harassment, and physical violations. And then you've got four different roles. Sometimes you're the leader, sometimes you're the upstander, sometimes you're the person who's harmed, and sometimes you're the person who caused harm. So there's different suggestions for each of these situations. As you said, it's a thorough book. But I think at a high level, the thing that I would recommend for people to do is to think about a time when you did speak up and think about a time when you didn't speak up. And so I'll give you a couple of examples. One is, let's imagine bias in an interview process. So if you're going in to interview for a job and somebody says something to you that's biased, this is a moment where it feels maximally dangerous to speak up. But let me tell you a story about a time when I did speak up and a time when I didn't speak up. So once I was I describe in the beginning of the book this terrible job that I had when I first got to Russia, or the Soviet Union as it was then. And I had a lot of bad experiences. I was underpaid. I was excluded from meetings because they all happened naked in the sauna. I was sort of sexually assaulted by a couple of executives at the company. I mean, it was bad. And so I was eager to get out of this job, we'll put it that way. And I was, a friend of mine had noticed the impact that this was having on me and said, you gotta go interview, and introduced me to a company. And so I was interviewing. I really liked the company. I liked the person who I was, who was the CEO of the company. I admired him. He was a Holocaust survivor who had started this company when he was still in high school in order to support his family. And so at the very end of the interview process, he says to me, because I'm going to go work for him in Russia, he says to me, "Russia is a very sexist society. How are you going to deal with that?" And I was pissed. I was like, you know, it is your job as my employer to have my back here. And I looked at him and I said, you know what? It's also a very anti-Semitic society. And then yet I know plenty of Jews who are very successful there. And then as soon as I said that, I wanted the floor to open up and swallow me. I thought, oh my God, have I said something that is, have I just fought bias with bias? Like, and luckily he loved my answer and hired me on the spot. So there was maybe I would have gotten hired even if I had responded in a more measured and diplomatic way. But I think that I wouldn't have gone into the job with the same confidence that my boss had my back. And that would have made a big difference. So there was a big upside to confronting the bias. And then, so now fast forward 20 years anyway. And I had just had children and I had decided I needed to leave my current job. And I was starting to interview for new jobs. And by the way, in this second story where I'm going to tell you a story about not confronting bias in the interview, I was much more able to confront bias. I was more established in my career. When I challenged bias in the interview about the Russia job, I think I had $12 in the bank. Like I really needed that. I needed to get out of that. And now fast forward 20 years, I'm in a much more secure situation. And yet when I was interviewing at this company and I really liked the company and I really liked the founders, and again, we're getting towards the end of the interview day. And one of the founders explains to me, he says, we do yoga together as a team every day at 7 p.m. And my mind is reeling. I'm like, oh my God, you do yoga at 7 and then I get home, it's done at 8 and then I get home at 9. I'll never see my children again. And I didn't say a word. I just like ran away. I just sort of withdrew from the interview process. And I got to know this founder later and I'm 100% sure if I had said something to him, he would have been incredibly apologetic and said, we'll change it to 4 o'clock yoga or whatever. But I didn't. I didn't confront the sort of bias against parents inherent in that practice. And therefore, I didn't get a job that I was well qualified for and potentially interested in. So I think that there's just, if you really start thinking about the cost of raising these things, it's rarely as great as we imagine it to be kind of in our gut. We gotta question our gut, our instinct to remain silent.
And I was thinking too, has it gotten any better in the last 5 years with the Me Too movement and all this kind of stuff? It always seems like for me, the best advice or the best philosophy going in is to believe women, because more often than not, to come forward, it's brutal. And it's rare that there's the false accusation. They usually pay a terrible price. There's always a bit of a cover-up for the most part when you confront power. Has it at least improved, perhaps? Was the Trump era as bad as it was? Was it at least perhaps a flip side of that? Has it brought more attention to this and thus there was improvement?
So I think some things have gotten better. Some things definitely got worse in the last 4 years. I think that one thing that has changed is that this younger generation is less likely to put up with extreme nonsense. I put up with so much. I didn't even recognize problems. And when I was early in my career, one of the moments that really struck me was when I read Susan Fowler's blog post. Susan Fowler was the engineer at Uber. And when I read that, I thought, my God, you know, she's way earlier in her career than I am. And yet when I have been confronted with similar situations, I never would have written about it publicly the way she did. And the way she wrote about it produced a lot of change. It was, you know, one of the early Me Too reckonings in tech. And so I think that is great. And I think that's a sign for optimism. But the fact that people are writing about it doesn't mean it's not happening anymore. The fact that people are speaking about it is not in and of itself the solution. There still have to be consequences for these behaviors. And too often the consequences are not significant enough to stop the behaviors. And then the other thing that I would say that happened is I've heard from so many people that the sort of the ethos of the Trump administration emboldened people to behave towards women, towards all every underrepresented person, towards Black people in particular, but it emboldened people who have real prejudices to live out those prejudices in a way. So that I talked earlier about, you, there needs to be a line between someone's freedom to believe something and but they're not free to act on that belief. They're not free to impose that belief on others. I think that that line moved in the wrong direction in the last 4 years.
Especially systematically, I would agree. Because it's one thing if you hold a personal prejudice, but if you put the power of a system behind it, which has been going on for 400 years, but it kind of the, we did a major U-turn 4 years ago, 4.5 years ago. And a lot of people took the hoods off, came forward. Yeah, it's sad, but hopefully maybe we could turn the ship around. It's still embryonic, this new path, but again, we're still fighting it all the time. It's amazing. It just like doesn't go away.
Yeah, it is amazing that it doesn't go away. And yet I am optimistic. We're at a moment in time where there are more people who are emerging from denial, who are open to listening to the stories and to taking positive action. I think it's crucial, though, that we come up with things that people can do to make situations better, to move things forward. Because I think what'll happen if people sort of become more aware of these problems and nothing is done, then they'll roll over. You know, I think it's like everyone was in a deep sleep and they woke up and saw what was happening, noticed what was happening. And if we don't give them things that they can do to make it stop happening, then it'll be too painful to notice and they'll roll back over and go back to sleep.
More trauma, right? More levels of unhealed trauma, which is what we're seeing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kim, what does a healthy, proactive, conscious leadership look like?
So leaders who are really committed to changing these behaviors, here are some things that they can do. I'm not saying that I have all the answers, but here's some specific things that leaders can do. If they're concerned about bias in their organization, and every leader should be concerned about bias, because I assure you that in every meeting that is happening every day at your company, bias gets expressed. So one of the things that we can do is bias interrupters, bias disruptors. So this is sort of sit down with your team and think about what's the word that you're going to use to interrupt bias when you hear it in a meeting. So it could, or a phrase, it could be, I don't think you meant that the way it sounded. It could be bias alert. It could just be bias. One team said, we're going to throw a purple flag, and they actually got props. You know, they throw a purple flag. And so that's the first part, is having a shared vocabulary for recognizing and interrupting bias when it gets expressed in a meeting. And then the second part, and this is crucial, that the second thing that leaders need to do is they need to create a norm for how to respond, because it can feel very much like an attack when someone points your bias out to you. And so just let people know you can do two things when your bias gets pointed out to you. You can either, if you understand why what you said causes harm, you can say, thank you for pointing it out. I'm sorry. I won't say it again. Or thank you for pointing it out. I'm sorry. If I say it again, please point it out again. I'm working hard, but sometimes it takes time to change your vocabulary. And if you don't understand the problem with what you just said or did, then say, I don't quite get it. Can we talk after the meeting? And this is really important, because if bias is going to arise in every meeting that we have cannot be about bias. We will not get shit done. So we need to interrupt it quickly and then return to the matter at hand, the reason why we were having the meeting. So that's bias. What do you do about prejudice? This is much harder. But I think leaders need to take responsibility for making clear what's that line in their company where people can, a leader cannot control people's beliefs, but they can say, they can create sort of a rule book for respect. So there are things that you can, and cannot do or say in our organization. And it can't be the, so I call that a code of conduct. Leaders need to like write that down as explicitly as possible. And then it's going to have to change over time. And you've got to keep editing it. You got to keep it short, this code of conduct. If it's too long, nobody, it's irrelevant. Nobody will ever read it. And then for bullying, leaders have to create consequences for bullying. They have to create conversational consequences. They have to make sure that they interrupt the bullying that happens in a meeting. They don't just let it stand. There has to be a consequence in the moment for someone who bullies someone else in a meeting. There also have to be compensation consequences. You can't give the highest bonus to the person who got great results but left a trail of the metaphorical trail of dead bodies in their wake. And last but not least, there have to be consequences for a career. It is so common that the brilliant jerk gets promoted in organizations. Don't do that. You've got to value results, but you also have to value teamwork. And if someone is consistently achieving results by bullying their peers or their employees, don't promote that person. And in fact, if they can't change their behavior, fire that person. So there've got to be consequences for bullying. And then when it comes to dealing with power, I think there's really three things to keep in mind to prevent discrimination, harassment, and physical violations. One, you want to create checks and balances in your organization. Power corrupts. And so when you give unilateral decision-making authority to anyone in the organization, whether it's a brand new manager or a CEO, then it's more likely that discrimination and harassment and physical violations are going to happen. So you want to make sure that you're creating systems that make decisions about hiring, about promotion, about pay, in a way that is governed by checks and balances, not by giving individual managers unilateral authority over those things. In terms of preventing discrimination, it's so important to start to measure your bias. I think you want to take a look at all those systems and you want to measure every step of the way and really proactively look for the ways that bias or discrimination is, bias or prejudice is influencing those decisions in a way that becomes discriminatory. So you want to take a look at your hiring, every step of your hiring process. You want to take a look at your promotion processes. You want to take a look at your compensation processes, and you want to measure what's happening. Are we paying men more than women? Are we paying white people more than black people? And why? You've got to keep asking the questions. This is not about, you know, if you were taking a look at profitability, you wouldn't say the solution to being unprofitable is cooking the books. But and yet so often, even leaders who are really committed to metrics, being metrics driven, refuse steadfastly to look at these kind of metrics. And if you don't look at the metrics and you don't dig in and understand why this is happening, then you're not going to fix the problem. And last but not least, we all need in every organization to have a very strong culture of consent. And this is not that complicated. If you are going to touch someone, whether you're going to shake their hand or kiss their cheek or rub their shoulders or something different, it is incumbent upon you to know if that person wants to be touched. And if they don't touch. It's really not that hard. And I'll give you an example. One time I was at a conference and I stuck my hand out to shake this person's hand who I was meeting. And I noticed he looked very uncomfortable. And so I pulled my hand back and I said, "You don't have to shake my hand." And he had religious reasons for not wanting to shake my hand, which I honored. Like, you don't have to touch me, even though a handshake is a normal business exchange. So I think it's really important to make sure that you have a culture of consent, and that that is backed up by a trusted reporting mechanism. So those are, there's a thousand other things that leaders can do. But
I love what you just said. And what I heard in all of that brilliance and detail was you got to walk your talk. You can't just put out a cool statement and then pay the abusers and underpay the other people, not respect the people. And really what it is it's alignment. If this is who you are, this is how the company performs, and a hell of a lot of listening. And one thing that permeated your book that really struck me over and over again was respecting individuality. It just seemed like that kept coming up in different forms. Am I right? Just respecting who people are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you take a look, if you think about, like, I just walked through a bunch of different things, which are probably impossible to keep in your mind all at the same time. But if you're a leader and you just want to remember two things, you need to do two things. You need to respect each person's individuality rather than demanding conformity. And nobody really starts a company thinking, or, you know, becomes CEO thinking that they can't, that they want to create a 1984, everybody wears the same gray suit kind of, you know, nobody wants to demand conformity, or I shouldn't say nobody, but most leaders don't really want to demand conformity. They want to respect individuality. And yet you've got to understand the subtle ways in which we demand conformity as we go along. So that's one thing, is respect individuality. And then the other thing is you want to optimize for collaboration, not coercion. And again, most leaders do not want to be totalitarian kind of leaders. They want their teams to collaborate. And yet so often we give in to the temptation to want to kind of coerce people. And so we've got to manage against that very, very carefully.
Well, short term it's easier, but it's bad long term.
Yeah, and even it's bad, I would argue, in the short term. Maybe not the day of, but the next, like, it's bad pretty fast.
What do you think about meditation as part of companies? And then on a personal level, do you meditate to increase awareness?
So I read the research on meditation and I believe it, but meditation does not, what I need to do every day, here are the things I need to do every day to remain centered. I need to exercise for an hour. I need to sleep for 8 or 9 hours. And I need to have a conversation with someone I love. And if I can do those things every day, no matter how chaotic the world around me is, I can stay centered. And if I don't do those things every day, no matter how easy and straightforward my life is, it seems impossible. So those are the things that work for me. But I think meditation works for a lot of people and is a great thing.
That's so wonderful that we have the same big three. And I could skip a day of exercise, but if it's like five in a row because of rain or it's hard, I get funky. I love having these conversations. The great day is when I have a podcast guest like you. And then I always try to talk to my friends around the world, especially this past year or so, because we have gotten physically isolated. I've isolated, been respectful. And just having conversations with people I love. I wake up thinking about gratitude, like, man, I can't believe I have a roof. I had a bed. I have coffee. It's brewing, a coffee machine. And so many people love me. And look at the birds. And I love nature. So I'm setting the mind on a gratitude path. I go to bed thinking about what went right today. This will be on that list. And then if I can move my body walking, I like to bike ride or go along the beach. It's just a better day. And you got to get a good night's sleep or the whole day sucks. I don't care how many good things happen. I'll be funky like a little toddler who's ready for his nap. I try to do a few minutes of meditation and then I have a better day if I eat well. And I can eat pizza here and there and I can do that. But if I make sure I get the green juice and it's mostly healthy. And no process. There's like all these things, because if I put chemicals in the machine or my car, it funks out. So, wow. You're just incredible. I mean, I hope the audience isn't, you know, getting annoyed at me gushing, but Yeah, I just love what you're doing in the world and that you keep doing it. The last question, and we'll let you go. It is harder for women, and it's harder for women of color in general. It's a fact. Will you speak to the people around the world, the women who have a dream, who want to be leaders, who want to run a company or do whatever, or just live in peace? Any inspiring words from your heart to theirs? Because here we all are.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's so much depressing. There's so much depressing news out there, and sometimes the research on bias can be very discouraging. It'll say women who negotiate hard get punished, or women who are funny get punished. And then one of the things that happens is I'll get these emails from young women, and they're like, should I not negotiate? Should I not be funny? And my response is, no, go out there and be fucking hilarious and negotiate as hard as you can. And don't stop. Just don't stop. Just keep doing it. And don't let all this bad news and all this bias, don't let it dictate. Go be your fullest, most awesome self. And yes, you're definitely gonna experience some bias. You're gonna experience some stuff that's even at least in the short term more difficult to deal with than bias. But you can get through this. Like for all of the crap I put up with in my career, I've had a wonderful career. I've loved my career. I've been relatively successful, and I'm really happy. And so you can push your way through these things.
Bravo. And all right, the bonus question. What if we made it illegal for men to run anything, including government and companies, and only women could do it? Would the world work better?
No. You know, I'm a believer in diversity, and I love men. And you know, we need men. And we need women, and we need all of us. That's the whole point of this is to come up with a better way to work together, so that we can all just get stuff done. If anytime we're excluding half the world's population, that can't be the right answer.
And of course, a woman would say that. And if only we could get the men to think that way.
Yes. It would be a better world for sure. And I will say I'm a little optimistic about this book and its ability to do that. My father told me when I was back home, but before he died, he said, you know, on New Year's Day, he got together with some of his friends, and these are super conservative men in the South. And he said, you know, we were talking about your book, and we were trying to figure out like who was the bad guy in some of these stories, and we realized it's a systemic problem. And I'm like, yes, they understand systemic injustice. And so I really do think it is important to begin talking to each other and telling each other stories and building these bridges to include everyone.
Wow, and what's your father's name? Let's dedicate the show to him and give him a spiritual universal shout out.
Let's do that. Alan Taylor Malone.
Oh, God bless him. And has he ever come back to you yet in a dream, or is that still to come?
Every time I wake up, I find that I'm thinking about him. I don't always remember my dreams, but he must be coming back to me.
Wow. Well, you've just been a delight, and I hope you'll come back to us. You don't need to write another masterpiece. Just come back whenever you want. We'd love to have you as part of the What Matters Most family, and I'm very grateful that you came on today.
Well, thank you so much. Such a great conversation. Really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.